Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am so glad to be welcoming to the morning show for the very first time Thomas Klein, who is Associate Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at Carthage College and also bears the title of Chief of Staff. And as a matter of fact, at least in recent memory, he's the first person to hold such a position at Carthage. He is part of the process of doing some restructuring of administration and staff at Carthage with the arrival of Carthage's president, Gregory Woodward. And part of his work at Carthage, that is Thomas Klein's work at Carthage, involves work with the Graduate Professional Studies Program, GPS. And in line with that, recently there was the announcement of two full-ride scholarships that are part of that program, scholarships earmarked for adults in the Kenosha area. And so we're going to be talking about that while we also get to know Thomas Klein and his background and a little bit more about the work that he does at Carthage College. Thomas Klein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Gregory. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks
Happy
for taking
New Year
the time.
To you.
Happy
yeah.
New Year to you.
Good to have you here. You arrived, as I just mentioned, on the heels of Gregory Woodward, who has been a past colleague of yours. So as President Woodward got into place, you were someone that he wanted to have close at hand, and so you are doing a lot of important work on his behalf. Ahead of you even knowing Gregory Woodward, let's find out about where you come from even before that. Where are you from originally?
Oh, I'm from upstate New York, Cortland area. Went to school at Ithaca College, and then studied music and business. And after graduation, I became a full-time musician. And so I went out and traveled and played percussion and drum set in rock bands, jazz bands, Latin bands, had a private drum studio, had a couple music businesses. You know, as any working musician knows, you have to have your hands in a lot of different pots to make ends meet. And then this amazing position came open at Ithaca College that was a good fit for me. So they asked me to apply, and I applied, and that was, I think, 6 or 7 years after graduation. So then I returned to my alma mater, and that's where I met President Woodward, and we worked very closely together for 5 years within the School of Music at Ithaca.
Great. So it sounds like, in a sense, a new position was created, and somebody thought you would be a good match for it. What position are we talking about?
So there were two positions. The first time, it was very interesting. The record labels were sued by the state of New York for payola, for bribing radio stations to play their artists. And so there was a settlement of around $30 million, and that was allocated to the Rockefeller philanthropic advisors. And they then distributed the funds across New York to support underrepresented music. And so the grant that Ithaca College received was about aging and creativity. And so we sponsored some concert series for artists over the age of 65. So we brought in Billy Taylor before he passed, Chico Hamilton, Marion McPartland, all these fantastic artists for a concert series at Ithaca. And then we also promoted local music for local musicians in the area for elderly populations or elderly musicians themselves. So that was, it was a 2-year grant. And then after that being 1 year, the position of director of music admissions came open within the School of Music. And so I was asked to apply for that. And so I transitioned into that role after 1 year.
Wow.
So it was a lot of fun, and we did a lot of great things.
Hmm. Well, then it says something about the size and importance of the School of Music at Ithaca that the School of Music would have its own director of admissions. And I imagine that was important and exciting work.
It was. So we have over 1,400 applicants for about, well, we had over 1,400 applicants when I was in that position. For around 150 positions every year. So it was highly selective, highly competitive. And we grew summer programs, we grew international admissions. And so throughout my life, everything I've been doing has been about building. So building programs, building concerts, promoting, making things happen. So President Woodward and I did that a lot at Ithaca together. And we, I hope, elevated the School of Music even to a higher level by the time we left. And so admissions was at an all-time high, applications were at an all-time high, and the level of students and music making was on its way up. And looking back, I probably would not have been accepted 10 years earlier to my own alma mater. And I know that many people think the same way when they look back, but everything was on an upward trajectory.
Wow. So you elevated the school out of your own reach in some ways. That's yeah. A nice problem to create. How did that transition ultimately feel for you in terms of being a full-time musician versus immersing yourself in music administration in that way? I mean, I shouldn't assume that you were leaving active music making behind you, and yet I'm sure to some extent you were. What did that feel like? What does that feel like to this day?
Well, that was one of the questions that I had that was a little scary when I made the transition, but it was a transition. So it wasn't like you just shut the faucet off and stop playing. So I went from playing around 150 gigs per year to about 100 gigs a year, and then down to 50, which was and then I maintained that for many years because it was that was a nice doable number. I did a lot of traveling for admissions work at Ithaca, and so I could fit in gigs here or there and choose the gigs that I wanted to play rather than having to play every gig to make ends meet. So it was a transitional period, but it was at a time where I, got married to my longtime sweetheart, Gina, where we met at Ithaca as freshmen, and we started, a family together, and so I was ready to move away from life on the road and be, move in a different direction. Mm. And I was thankful that I had an education, a well-rounded education, that allowed me to do so, much like the education that students at Carthage receive. Mm. So it was nice to have a broad set of skills in addition to a high-level music talent that allowed me to go into many different directions when the time called.
And had you chosen to be a business major in addition to a music major with very specific ideas in mind about how that business major would serve you? I mean, and did you envision business within the sphere of music, or was there no particular rationale to you being a business major as well as a music major, except just it was one more thing you were interested in?
So I really, to be completely honest, I did the business for my mother. she was very worried that I was going to be a starving musician and I needed a backup plan. And so the double major, Ithaca has a great program where it's called Music in Combination with an Outside Field. And so the double major became an outside field, which is an elevated minor, if you will. So I whetted my appetite on a lot of the business aspects and became, accustomed to thinking in a business way that I applied to music making. So it was applicable and useful, and I didn't know how I would use it, but I certainly have used both to a great extent.
Mm. And then, of course, you end up making the move to Carthage not long after Gregory Woodward makes that move. This is maybe too personal a question, but I'll ask it anyway and just flick it away if you'd rather not answer. But was it a fairly fairly solid possibility, maybe even a certainty, that when he accepted this position at Carthage, that this invitation was going to be issued from him? Or did he get here and realize, oh my gosh, where's Tom? I mean, even before he departed Ithaca, was this possibility in the air that your teamwork, in a sense, would go on from there?
I think the possibility was in the air, and we talked a little bit about it before he arrived here. But then he certainly wanted to get a feel for what the landscape was like here and what was needed and how I could be of use to the institution. And so throughout that year, there were a lot of ideas and projects that came up, and there was really nobody within the administration that could take the ball and run with them, because everybody has over a full-time job, you know, as most administrators do, and there wasn't the extra manpower and time to take some of these programs and see them through to reality. And so that's where, you know, based on what my previous skill sets were and experience, I could most help the institution. And so it was a great fit. It was a natural fit, and something that I really jumped at when the opportunity came up.
Well, that anticipates what was my next question. Was it a foregone conclusion that you would say yes to this opportunity, or was it a difficult thing to say yes to? I mean, in terms of leaving behind your alma mater and obviously a situation in which you were already enjoying tremendous success.
It was a difficult decision based on those, and primarily because of both my wife and our family are back in upstate New York. So it was the first time that we would be moving out of the state, away from family, with a young family, you know, so that they wouldn't be around grandparents. And so that was a difficult decision and something that we had to kind of come to terms with. And, you know, you realize that Chicago, it's not like it's on the other coast. It's a 2-hour plane ride. It's a 12-hour car ride. And I shouldn't say Chicago area, Wisconsin. And so after we considered all the factors, we figured that it was worth a shot. And then my wife also received a job offer from Kenosha Unified School District, which made that decision all the easier, because she's a music teacher at Lance Middle School and two of the elementary schools as well.
Very good. We're speaking with Thomas Klein, who is now Associate Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Chief of Staff at Carthage College. And so when did you actually begin at Carthage?
I began August of 2013, so a little over a year and a half ago.
Right. So tell us particularly about this position called Associate Vice President of Strategic Initiatives. What is sort of the truth behind those kind of intimidating terms or the words? I mean, what is the heart and soul of your responsibilities?
So my job is to take ideas and projects and initiatives that the faculty generate, that the administration generates, and sometimes that I generate, I guess do some market research, test them, and then if they're a good move, then see them through to reality. And so this past year, the first year on the job, there were three major projects that I was working on. One was to investigate the feasibility of a nursing program at Carthage. The second was to develop a downtown center in downtown Chicago for Carthage called Carthage in Chicago. And the third were international initiatives that I explored. So the first being nursing, it was a long process and a very inclusive process with the faculty and staff and administration, and we produced a report at the end that evaluated many aspects of nursing, and in the end, both the faculty and the administration and the trustees voted to approve with going through with the program. So we hired a founding director over the summer, and he's been working on developing the program this fall, and I'm pleased to say that it's been approved both to plan and to admit students by the Wisconsin Board of Nursing, and now we're awaiting approval from our accrediting body, the Higher Learning Commission. So we should receive that hopefully within the next couple months, and then we'll have a Bachelor of Science in Nursing program, which we're very excited about. And we're also that also interfaces with the community in many different ways. So we're excited about expanding our partnerships both with our institutional partners, higher education with Gateway and Parkside, our healthcare partners, and our other community members. So we really feel excited about the possibility of nursing. We hope that the first class starts in the fall of 2015, but it depends on our accrediting body and how quickly they can move. And I guess if we receive approval, you know, then moving forward. So that's the big project for last year, and another project was this Carthage in Chicago program, which we launched this past fall, which was wildly successful. The students are very excited and have had amazing experiences. It's essentially a downtown campus for Carthage. So the students had the benefit of attending college in a relatively safe setting, in a rural environment on a beautiful lake, but then having this amazing experience in the downtown city of Chicago, where they have an internship and they can take a variety of classes taught by Carthage professors that utilize the resources of the city. So some of the classes were involved art and museums. So the classroom was at the Field Museum and the Art Institute. One of them involved the politics and plays of Chicago. So students attended plays and other activities like that, and evaluated the politics associated with them. So there, it was a very rich experience, and the students just completed that, and their feedback's been really positive. So that was very, very good. And then International Initiatives has primarily surrounded China for the time being. There's a lot of opportunity there currently, both from a recruiting standpoint and a program development standpoint. So I've made many trips to China and to Hong Kong, and we've expanded our relationships there, and we're developing some really interesting programs that, once they're solidified, we'll be able to announce more publicly.
So when you explore a potential possibility, such as Carthage having a nursing program, is this ultimately something where is part of your responsibility to arrive at a determination that, yes, this makes sense, yes, we should go forward, or is your responsibility just before that, I mean, in terms of assembling all the facts, all the various perspectives, and then handing over that sort of ultimate determination to somebody else? Or is part of your responsibility to sort of see all these facts and then, in a sense, make a recommendation that, yes, it makes sense for us to do this? Not that you have the authority to to turn the light green, but I mean, is part of your responsibility to sort of make an important and informed recommendation about such possibilities?
Well, I'm part of the discussions at all the levels, from the research to the cabinet level discussions to the Board of Trustees discussions. But it's certainly a very collaborative effort with everything we do. So in the case of nursing, we did so much research and so much groundwork that the decision was fairly self-evident. When the faculty voted to support it, it was I think a 98% approval from the faculty. So it was a relatively non-controversial, and the decision was clear.
Pretty emphatic.
Pretty emphatic. So, and that decision carried through for the officers at the college and for the trustees as well. So my job is to serve as the catalyst, and I think the information gatherer and the energy behind the project. And if it's not a good idea or not feasible, typically it won't make it to that. It won't make it much farther than those stages. So I'm not directly responsible for saying yes or no, but I'm in charge of the conversations. And if we've done our due diligence and the research is sound, then it's a pretty self-evident decision.
And I suppose, in a sense, it's not every idea, especially the outrageous ones, ends up on your desk. I mean, if someone thinks we should have our own space station program, chances are that's going to get shot down before it ever reaches Thomas Klein's desk, I'm guessing.
Well, it typically reaches my desk.
Oh. Lucky
and
you.
And then sometimes I have to do the shooting down. It hasn't happened too frequently yet because we have a lot of good ideas that we're pursuing currently. We explore all different great possibilities.
Before we explore a little bit more about the graduate professional studies program, GPS, and these exciting scholarships about to be offered, I wanted to ask you just something a little more general, which is just, what does it feel like to be at a place like Carthage, which is a profoundly different institution from your own alma mater in terms of size and, I'm guessing, in quite a number of other ways as well? What does it feel like? Does it professionally yet, in a sense, feel like home? Or do you find yourself day by day still sort of confronting a lot of those differences between the two institutions?
Well, the institutions, they are different, but they could be much more different. So Ithaca was a size of 6,000, and within the School of Music, we had 600 students. So it was a family-like atmosphere within the School of Music. Within the college itself, it's about twice the size of Carthage. So, it's not as different as coming from a large university, Research One University, where there might be 30,000 or 40,000. Right. So the class sizes are the same. The general mantra of personal attention to students and close relationships is the same. So there are many things that cross over between institutions. It's been very easy to come to Carthage, and I've found that the community has been very welcoming. And the first year, I think, in any position is you're just learning the ropes. And I think what really made a difference was when everybody came back in August, just the personal relationships I'd made over that year. We had a committee for every project that I've been working on, so I worked very closely with the faculty and the students and the administration. And to see everybody come back and just have that feeling of, family, which is such a Carthage hallmark, was there. And so I think it was, the first year is always difficult, but as of this past August, I think everything's firing on, all cylinders, and it feels like home, definitely.
Excellent. For those of you just joining us on today's Morning Show Part 1, I'm speaking with Thomas Klein, who is Associate Vice President of Strategic Initiatives and Chief of Staff at Carthage. Before we're done, I'll ask you a quick question about what it means to be Chief of Staff. Yeah. But let's get into this matter of GPS, the Graduate Professional Studies Program. First of all, in a nutshell, for our listeners who aren't not acquainted with it, what kind of things does it offer?
Fantastic. So one of the initiatives for this coming year is to take a look at our graduate professional studies program and offer new programs, promote it, and just do some really cool things with it. So the three areas that we deal with most in graduate professional studies is, number one, our adult undergraduate studies program, and this is for adults, typically over the age of 24. Our average student is age 30. We offer evening courses in an accelerated 7-week format, taught by most of our full-time faculty and other faculty, professionals in the area. We offer majors in business, education, and criminal justice, and then some other majors where you can complete your general education requirements in the evening and then complete in the daytime program, like social work. And so that's a very popular program, and we're looking to expand that. We're looking to expand partnerships with our local community partners, specifically with Gateway Technical College, which allows graduates from Gateway to complete a 4-year degree at Carthage in a more seamless way. Mm. And so we're currently in discussions about how to do that and creating a program specially tailored for those students. So we're very excited about that program. Just making sure everything else we do is at the highest level possible. And the feedback from students has been very positive over these last couple months. So that's been great. The other thing we do within graduate professional studies is graduate programs. Our largest program is the Masters of Education. So many local teachers return to Carthage to receive their master's degree, and we have 12 concentrations that they can receive their degree in. And We also offer a partnership with Loyola University in Chicago for social work. So that's a very robust program as well. So those are our graduate programs, and we're looking to develop more graduate programs, specifically in the area of business. So those will hopefully come to fruition over the next, I think, 2 years. And then we also offer professional development opportunities. So enrichment programs for local teachers, which is they can receive professional development credit, and that's 3 times a year, and then some other programs like paralegal studies and our certificate of managerial accounting, CMA. Yeah. So there's a lot of programs that we offer, and we serve over 800 students every year in the Kenosha area.
Is it at all a tricky matter to meld these kind of offerings with everything else that Carthage does, that Carthage offers in terms of its offerings to its just standard four-year students? Does it draw attention or draw resources away from that, or is it set up in such a way that these programs can flourish and grow without, in a sense, any detrimental effect to Carthage's central mission? Does that question make sense?
Yes. So I would say that this is... I would say that this is very closely aligned, if not completely aligned, with Carthage's central mission, because to hear the stories of the community service that it provides to our local population, and hear the stories of students who are returning to college to complete their degree or to start their degree. We have veterans from the military returning from Iraq who are completing their degree. We have working mothers who their children are off to school, and this is the first chance that they've had to return to start or complete their degree. So very heartwarming stories. Everybody, the thing about adults as opposed to 18-year-old students is that everyone has a very rich story because they've had more years behind them. And so to hear the impact that an advanced degree has had on their life, on their professional development, on their personal development, is just extremely rewarding, and that completely aligns with the Carthage mission of seeking strength, seeking truth. Shoot, I should know that. The Carthage mission. We'll put a period at
yeah,
the end
right.
of that.
Yeah, right. There you go. But I mean...
And in terms of resources, the faculty are... many of the full-time faculty teach within the program, and they're... The response that we receive from the faculty who teach in the program is that these are some of their favorite classes to teach, because of how responsive the students are, because of the depth of the conversations, because of the life experiences that these students have. And so it's a very rich environment educationally. And I think moving forward to have more of our, it's our goal to have more of our traditional college-age students mix with our adult students so that they're exposed to the depth of those conversations as well.
I remember with great, great fondness the times that I've taught back when it was called ACE, the Accelerated Carthage Experience, and particularly when Carthage had first developed this relationship with Snap-on and would offer opportunities to a number of Snap-on employees from all across the country to come to Carthage and complete their degrees. And my word, when in all of my years at Carthage, some of the most exciting moments for me as a teacher were standing in front of those 18 employees from Snap-on Tools and experiencing their incredible energy. They appreciated on the deepest level every moment they were spending in that classroom. It was incredible to be part of
that. We've actually had over 50 years of experience in adult education. And so we've had many iterations of the program as the world has evolved and as the market has evolved. And so we really know what we're doing. And the tradition of Carthage College in itself of having over 180 or 170 years
something
of educational experience, we really draw upon that to create a very quality educational experience for our students. One of the differences between our program and some, I guess, some other programs or an online program is that the students study in classes. Since it's in classrooms on our campus, they have access to our library, they have access to our computer labs, they have access to all of the resources that we have. We've invested over $200 million in our physical plant at the college within the last 15 years or so. So they have full access to the tremendous amount of resources that the college brings. So their experience as an adult student might be vastly different than an online program, say. So that's what that's what we offer, and that's what we're focusing on moving forward. With that said, because it's an accelerated format, there is an online component where there's learning outside of the classroom that takes place on the computer. So it's a blended, we use the term blended format of in-class and online, but we feel that the quality of the instruction in the classroom and the quality of the discussion is a cornerstone of the Carthage experience that that is unique to us that we are holding on to.
So tell our listeners about these two new scholarships that are being offered as part of this GPS program.
So back in the history of Kenosha, Wisconsin, when Carthage moved to this area, the city set aside the land, and in return, Carthage agreed to provide a certain number of full tuition scholarships to its residents. And so for the traditional age program, that's a robust scholarship competition, and within the adult education or the adult undergraduate studies program, we have the same model. So we have two full ride scholarships. They're 4-year scholarships valued at over $60,000 apiece. The students can apply online. You have to be over the age of 24, so you have to be an adult student of adult age to apply for the scholarships. And it can be done right from our website. So www.carthage.edu/GPS. And then on the left-hand sidebar, there's a Kenosha Scholarship button. And so if your listeners are interested, or if they know of somebody else who is interested, carthage.edu/GPS, click on the sidebar that says Kenosha Scholarship, and you can read more about the specifics. But we're very excited about that. We typically receive many applications for that because it's such an amazing opportunity.
Of course. And as you mentioned, the deadline is January 15th. If somebody is hearing about this for the first time today, do they have time between now and the 15th to get that application put together? I mean, how extensive a process are we talking about?
So there's an online application. There is, I believe it's a 400-word essay that's required about what the scholarship would mean to them, and then it's just some other fields to complete. So I think the initial processes should be very quick. It may take an hour or two or less, depending on how quickly they write or type. So I think it's a relatively easy process, and we encourage anybody, if you're even remotely interested, to complete an application and then let our panel of judges review it, and then somebody will be in contact you to discuss your application.
Very good. Remind our listeners again of exactly where they find that application on the website.
So it's www.carthage.edu/GPS. And then on the left column, there's a button that says Kenosha Scholarship.
Very good. In our closing minute or so, tell our listeners, on top of all of what else you've described today, what a chief of staff does at Carthage.
So a chief of staff works very closely with the president about on initiatives and about kind of the daily running of the college. So we are, I think this is public news. Public, we're launching a capital campaign for the college. Mm-hmm. It's got to be public because the staff has raised over $1 million towards this campaign. So it's underway and. The president is going to have a very busy travel schedule over the next few years fundraising for that campaign, which includes this brand new $43 million science building that part of which will come online by the end of the month. So there's a lot of great projects that he will be undertaking over these next coming months and years. And so it's essentially a greater help to him while he's away to make sure that things are running smoothly and the job's getting done.
Very good. Well, all kinds of exciting things going on.
And one more thing, I would be remiss if I didn't get our mission correct. It is seeking truth, building strength, and inspiring service together.
All that alliteration is careful, a little tricky to keep track of. But all kinds of exciting things to talk about, and it's fun to find out more about you at the heart of so many of the exciting innovations and new undertakings at Carthage. Associate Vice President Thomas Klein, it's been great to have you here on the morning show today. I look forward to your future visits, and Happy New Year to you and your family.
Thank you, Greg. Happy New Year to you and your listeners as well.
Good to have you here. The time is 8:46. This is the morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. This portion of the morning show is spent with Joshua Kendall, the author of a couple of very interesting books before this, The Man Who Made Lists, about the creator of Roger's Thesaurus, and The Forgotten Founding Father, a biography of Noah Webster. In his newest book, America's Obsessives, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation, Joshua Kendall explores the inner lives, so to speak, of some very important Americans, each involved in a different arena, and how each of them was, in Mr. Kendall's term, an obsessive innovator, and that obsessive-compulsive tendencies in their own personalities was part of what led them to their own particular greatness. It's a fascinating book, and I'm glad we can have a few minutes to speak with Joshua Kendall about his book, again called America's Obsessives. Joshua Kendall, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's a pleasure to be on with you.
In your introduction, you mention a couple of other previous books written by other people looking at particular great Americans and bringing up the possibility that certain personality disorders were an important ingredient in their greatness. In what way is your book a departure from those other books? What are you talking about that is in sharp distinction to what some of these earlier books pointed out?
Right. What I'm interested, as a biographer, I'm always interested in getting inside of my subject's head. And what I found is that previous biographers have neglected an important avenue of investigation, which is the connection between internal preoccupations and external achievement. So internal preoccupations are your thoughts and feelings, and obsessives are often obsessed with cleanliness and order and rules and lists, and that has a direct link to their greatness. Steve Jobs would take white gloves and look for dust on the floor of the Apple factory, and cleanliness became a synonym for his brand. The same was true of Henry Heinz, was a cleanliness nut, and the Heinz factory for half a century was a must-see tourist destination because of its cleanliness. Previous psychiatrists have talked about the relationship maybe between a mood disorder and success. But I'm trying to link between what goes on inside people's heads, particular thoughts and feelings. Steve Jobs was obsessed with making insanely great products. When he was dying and he was in his hospital, he had an oxygen mask on, and he hated the design of the mask, and he rips it off. I mean, design is more important to him than life itself. And that's what I was trying to capture. Melville Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System, and that was really the 19th century Google, the 19th century search engine. He was always thinking about 10. He loved the metric system. He liked to sleep 10 hours a night. And his ingenious classification system was based on 10s. So that's what I'm trying to connect. And again, it was exciting for me because as a biographer, I love to get inside people's heads and these people, and it was really available with this crowd of super achievers.
How did you come up with this particular list? Thomas Jefferson, Henry Heinz, Melvin Dewey, Alfred Kinsey, Charles Lindbergh, Estee Lauder, Ted Williams. Did you first come across this obsessive tendency in one of them and then look for others, or did they present themselves to you as a group?
Yes, I had written, as you mentioned, two books about obsessive lexicographers, people who made dictionaries, Noah Webster and Peter Mark Roget. And Webster and Jefferson were always arguing. They were contemporaries. And I began to notice, oh, my God, Jefferson was a list maker, too. And that got me started. And once I had Jefferson, I wanted to choose people in different fields to show that it wasn't just dictionary makers or intellectuals, but also athletes and marketers and information technology specialists. And I ended up skimming, you know, hundreds of biographies about dozens of subjects, and I would use the criteria from psychiatry's Bible, the DSM, and if I found that a person had met the criteria, then I would move on to someone else. And once I had someone in one field, I would stop researching that field and then go to another field. Once I had a marketer, I went to an athlete. And once I had an athlete, I went to Charles Lindbergh, who was in aviation. And I also wanted to get people from every era of American history, from our founders to contemporary figure like Steve Jobs or someone from the mid-19th century like Henry Heinz. And I really want to start a national conversation to show that this is not the only path to achievement, but a standard path to achievement, that in our crazy competitive society, if you're single-minded and you can't stop thinking about a certain thing, that that's going to be an asset. Estee Lauder couldn't stop thinking about touching faces. As a little girl, she would help her mother put on her makeup, and she would do that for the next 80 years. She would do it on strangers. I make a joke at the beginning of the chapter that if it weren't for her business was kind of an alibi, and if it weren't for her business, she might have been arrested for assault with deadly face powder. But these individuals were able to channel their obsessions and to find greatness. There are a lot of people who have obsessions who never built billion-dollar companies, but I wanted to show that it could, if properly channeled, lead to greatness.
One of the most important points you make is that these obsessive innovators you talk about in the book are made more than born. That is, they were not simply born with some genetic disposition, but that they were also made, in a sense, fashioned by their life circumstances, and particularly the circumstances of their childhoods. Say a brief word about that.
Yes, the obsessionality becomes kind of a solution to the child's existential crisis. Ted Williams grew up in a very dysfunctional family. His mother was always away from home. She was a religious zealot trying to save San Diego's drunks and prostitutes. His father was an alcoholic, and he was by himself, and he came up with this ingenious way to feel connected and to feel alive, and that was by swinging a bat. His bat became for him what the blanket was for Linus in Charlie Brown. And he was around his bat all the time. He would swing it all the time. And he was a good athlete. And that he would carry his bat across the street to a guy who was like a chicken farmer. But the chicken farmer would pitch to him. And the bat enabled him to bring people into his life. And he couldn't stop thinking about hitting. He used to say, "I live only for my next time at bat." And when he treated the bat like people, like a person. When he was in the Red Sox, he had a special locker for his own bats. When he was with the Red Sox, he would travel to Kentucky to visit the bat factory. And when the president of Hillrick Bat Company died, he sent the family a condolence letter. He was the only player in Major League Baseball. So these obsessions start early, and they continue a lifetime. And again, in our culture, if you're extremely focused, it's often an asset in your career. It becomes a psychiatric disorder because it leads to a lot of interpersonal problems. My obsessives tend to have short marriages. They tend to neglect their children. Ted Williams hit 400, but he was 0-for-3 when it came up to appearing at the birth of his children. And that's where the psychiatric disorder comes in. But being a little bit unbalanced can be great for your career.
I wonder if you could just say a word about our third president, Thomas Jefferson. That chapter is especially fascinating, and you chronicle for us the chronicling which Thomas Jefferson did all his life, particularly obsessed with listing the weather, the temperature. I mean, even during his presidency, he would do this day after day, keep track of every cent he ever spent. You describe someone as who was constantly singing to himself. I mean, this is somebody whose face is engraved on Mount Rushmore. Did it feel strange to be writing about this great America, a great American, and in a sense be bringing to light these facets of him, which, if read a certain way, could in a sense kind of diminish his monumental status. Were you ever at all uncomfortable about that? How do you want us to think of Jefferson in the light of what you've written?
Yes, that's a really rich question, and it brings up a lot of issues, because I don't want to diminish the greatness. I mean, the 200 words, the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, I mean, those are the most beautifully written, you know, words in some of the most beautifully written words in the English language, and they've inspired freedom fighters for 250, you know, to almost 250 years. And there's a brilliance in Jefferson, and I don't want to touch that. I don't want people to blindly idealize. And those words are brilliant, but the man could be quirky. He loved lists. He kept track of every cent that he ever spent, and he was always in debt. And we see both the brilliance and the eccentricity of Jefferson in the Declaration itself. The preamble is brilliant, and he crams in all of the last 200 years of philosophy and those 200 words and John Locke, and it's all there, and it's a brilliant piece of writing. But the next part of the Declaration, which is much longer, is this sprawling list of King George III's 27 crimes. And John Adams thought it was ridiculous, and it's meandering, and no one quotes it today. And that's an example of how the eccentricity and the brilliance were side by side. And I want people to revere the achievements, that he was also a human being. He was very shy. A bunch of Duke University psychiatrists have diagnosed him with a social phobia. He hated to give speeches. He only gave two speeches during his whole career, his presidential career, his two inaugural addresses. And I really want people to see the man, to see the men behind the greatness, and to see all sides of the person. And Thomas Jefferson was a brilliant thinker who was so well read. But he also could be obsessed with minutiae. And while he was president, he kept a list of all the vegetable markets. You know, while he was while we were paying him as president, he was keeping track of the vegetable markets in Washington. He kept the 36 different vegetables. He knew when you could get a tomato for the earliest in February. And again, there was this quirky side to Jefferson. I think Americans, you know, we love to have our heroes, and I think we just need to see these people for who they really were, and that's not to demonize him or to say the Declaration is lousy or that he was actually a very successful president. He won re-election with 73% of the vote in 1804, and he was really a great president, not only a great writer, but that he also was quirky, and I think it's important for us, if we want to understand our history, to see the humanity behind some of these iconic figures.
As you yourself wrote, few are aware that America's apostle of freedom was as consumed by the petty as he was by the lofty. But you go on to say, of course, the point being made that sometimes behind the quirkiness of someone, there is the potential for extraordinary greatness. And certainly that plays out time and time again in the lives of the fascinating Americans you explore in your book, America's Obsessive, The Compulsive Energy That Built a Nation. Joshua Kendall, congratulations on a fascinating book. I very much enjoyed it and this chance to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my conversation with Robert Conlon, the author of one of the most interesting books ever written about police work and police officers. The book is called Blue Blood, and we'll dig into the distant archives, actually, of WGTD's morning show in order to bring you that.